1955 to 1977. That's 22 years. And then there was 8 years that, let's see, I guess 8 years when I was on Rail Route 1. So that makes, 30 years as a Rail Route carrier. And then there was 10 years in there where I was a city carrier, or I was in the Navy. Before I left Route 2, I was carrying, well, one place I was carrying the third generation. Now, the question of vehicles. During that time, I drove Fords, I drove Chevrolets, I drove Plymouths, I drove Dodges, I drove a Jeep, and I finally started driving VWs. I believe I wore out 7 VWs. And they were the most practical machine for this job that one can imagine. I took all the seats out, with the exception of the driver's seats. And then I took a piece of 3/4 plywood and cut the shape so it's fit down in all the places where the drivers were, or where the seats were. And I could throw mail in there and reach it, and it was a very, very convenient vehicle. The post office awarded me a 1,000,000-mile safe driving certificate. I think they kind of stressed a little bit, but then that was their decision. And the certificate is up here on the wall. It looks very nice. Now, in 1922, Dad traded the 7-pasture Chandler Touring he had for the equity in a farm at Billings. Now, in 22, Oklahoma farmland was not in great demand. The yields were not great. And wheat, we made 20 bushels the acre. The use of fertilizer was not common then. Of course, now when the fields are heavily fertilized, they make 40, 50, and sometimes 60 bushel to the acre. This was a rough quarter. I mean, there were 3 ditches coming down from up above, from the slopes above this place, and they sometime before they were terraced, there would be, we'd get one of these Oklahoma deluges, and they would, you could swim a horse in there, you get so much water. And in there was about 40 acres of good bottom land in there, though. However, there was a huge ditch running right down the middle of it. And Dad and my brother Fred spent a week out there with 4 horses and a tumble bug filling in that ditch. And they had a very, very nice piece of land there. In 1939, Dad gave me this farm. Now, I say he gave me the farm. He gave me an equity in it. Before he turned it over to me, he mortgaged it for every dime he could get out of it. And then it was up to us, and we paid it off, and had used it for security several times when we needed to borrow rather large amounts of money. Sometime in the 1950s, I had the brilliant idea, more or less brilliant idea, of trying to tame those floods that came down through the pasture there, covered this bottom land down there. I had the farm administration engineers lay out a dam, and then before the dam was put up, I went through there and I dug a trench 32 inches wide, 32 inches long, high, deep, and 40 feet long. no, 80 feet long. And I got oil barrels, 50-gallon oil barrels, and knocked the ends out of them and laid them in this trench with on bricks on edge, and then on each side there were bricks also. That was just used as spacers. And then I started mixing concrete. I know once I hauled out 42 bags of cement, and that was before ready-mix concrete was very common. Tom, my brother Tom, had a little mixer that I could belt onto the front end of the four-wheel drive Jeep and turn it that way. And I filled this whole ditch in with this ready mixer, with this concrete cement that I was mixing. And when I finished, these barrels gave me a tube through there, 22 inches in diameter. And then I had the dam put in. Well, now when these heavy rains came up above, they'd come in, they'd fill up behind this dam, and all that could go out would be what would go out through this 22-inch tube. And that pretty well took care of the flooding problem there. The later on, I raised the dam several feet to increase the flood control part of it. And I don't believe that it's been very, very few times when the when this has gotten so full that it has hit the spillways. Okay, then here's this nice floodplain back there. I get the brilliant, more or less brilliant idea of planting some trees in there. Pecan trees. In 1965, I planted 200 pecan trees back in there. Now, this is in the pasture, so I had to put a little fence around each one to keep the cattle out of it. Now, I think back, I couldn't possibly have done that. But there the trees are, and I'm the one that planted them. In digging the holes to plant them, I did have a little gasoline-powered 5-inch auger that I could bore a hole down 5 feet, and then I reamed it out by hand with an 8-inch auger, and I'd jam the tree down in that and fill it with water, and then pulled dirt in on it, and there the tree was. And in the 40 years since then, I have lost, I've maybe lost 50 of those trees. Some of this land where I planted that wasn't the best pecan growing land, and it's growing. It's putting out some nice pecans. I never intended to make a commercial deal out of it. I just wanted to leave a nice grove when I passed on. And this year we picked a lot of pecans, and I'm sure the neighbors did too. And the when they drop on the ground, the cows and the deer eat them, and of course the blue jays and crows get their share, and there's a lot of them still out there. Something totally irrelevant to what we've been talking about, but I was just thinking about the names of some of the cars that were put out at that time. There was a Dort, a Hupmobile, a Willie's Knight, a Chandler, and I don't know how many more their names there were. You never hear of them anymore, though. The first of the year in 1960, we moved from 2023 East Pine to 2909 West Main. It was a much nicer house, and we lived there until 1973, when we moved to 1506 South Hayes. Now, we moved in there in March, and in October, Enid had a terrible flood. I mean, there were 17 inches of rain fell in 8 hours. And I was waiting water in the house almost up to my waist. Mary Helen was on the table with the cat. And I was, as I watched the water creep up on the inside, I figured, well, when it hits the all these electrical outlet, well, we've had it, but we never even felt a tingle. And an electrician said that there was just so much water, it dissipated, never didn't bother anybody. But I couldn't open the door and go out because the water on the outside is about 2 feet higher than it was on the inside. But it went down fast, and there were motorboats running up and down Hayes Street out in front. And then afterwards, of course, we had the filthy task of cleaning up the house. I think a good clean fire would be preferable to the filth that goes in there. We had to pull all the rugs. Actually, Phillips University let their students out for 2 days to come and help us. And there were six boys came out where we were and pulled those rugs out. And I got in the house. It was a concrete-floored house. And we got in the house and started washing down the walls with the hose and brushing it out the door. And finally we got it so it was... and we got fans going in there to dry things out. But you know, we had a Frigidaire, a new Frigidaire. And the motor down there just kept chugging away, and I thought that would be one of the first things, but it was still working when the water was all gone. We lived in a motel for a few days, and then we moved back in, gradually started reaccumulating items. Now, one of my more brilliant things was that I started taking things out of, as the water rose, I started taking things out of the cabinets and setting them higher. And one place I picked up a whole bunch of newspapers, old newspapers, set them up high, and I left a big pile of Mary Helen's research papers that she was working on to get her PhD. And she had 40 hours toward the PhD degree, but I left them down there to get wet. Now, you talk about real smarts. We had two cars, Buick Riviera and the Bug. The Riviera was totaled, absolutely totaled, but the Bug, well, we drug it down to the VW place, and they drained all the fluids out of it and flushed everything out, and I think the bill was $60, and I drove it for thousands of miles after that and was never able to blame anything that happened to it on the flood. There was no insurance on the house or any of its contents. Flood insurance, at that time you couldn't get unless you'd had a history of flood. I had the FHA man come in and appraise what had happened, and he figured out $30,000 in damage, and I recovered that from my income taxes. Damage in the house, I wondered about the walls, you know, they were full of insulation and all that stuff, and I wondered about having to cut those out. But I had, on my route, I had two builders to talk to them, and they said, leave it alone. I said, if it begins to smell, then we can do something about it. This house on Hayes had a 6-foot wooden fence around it, and I put a nail in the fence to show how high the water got on it. And, I don't know, a couple of months later, why some government engineer came by, and he was asking me about the flood, and I showed him the nail. He used that as a benchmark to increase the carrying capacity of the diversion ditch, which ran across the back of the property, which is what caused us all the trouble in the first place. I'm going to change the subject completely and there are two things that I want to talk about, which probably you get a place here as any. In the Depression years, the library was kept open as much as they could because so people could get in there out of the cold. And the children would come in there to check out books and have their soup pails with them. Everybody seemed to be trying to help everybody, but nobody had anything with which to help. Then there were the dust bowls. Now, in Enid, we had dust. I mean, there was enough dust in Enid to put the street lights on at noon. But it wasn't something that originated. This originated out in the panhandle. I don't know if people had homesteaded out there or what had happened, but after World War I, the price of wheat was good. And people went out there and they plowed up these grasslands, which had held this soil for thousands of years. They plowed it up and put it in wheat. And they had a couple of good years. And then the bottom dropped out of the wheat, people left the farm. They just abandoned them. Well, all this loose soil and the wind started, and Oklahoma wind just continued being Oklahoma winds. And they started the dust blowing. And it blew mainly from the north or from the south. And I've heard people out there talk that it got so bad a time you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. Now, I don't see how you could live in something like that. I know my brother lost a car motor driving through some of this dust. But the dust would blow and cover up the fences. In the wintertime, we'd have these snowstorms, and the dust was underneath it, the dust is on top of it. And in the middle of the summer, you could dig down in there and here would still be the snow. The dust made a wonderful insulation there. In the years following, I should say, the Soil Conservation Service started working out there. One of the things which they did was plant shelter belts, which were rows of trees running east and west. The pervading winds, of course, were from the north and the south. And so they planted these rows of trees, hundreds of miles of them. I don't mean they continued for 100 miles, but just back and forth all through here. And there would be evergreens and deciduous trees in there, and I don't know, they might have been 150 feet wide, 200 feet, I don't know. But that was to break the theory was that would break the pervading winds. And some of these, now that's been over 75 years ago, and of course, most of those trees have died by now. The farmers pulled some of them up. But there are still remnants of these shelter belts out there, and you can see what was done at that time. But contrast that with what that country is like today. They discovered a very extensive aquifer underneath this, and they discovered, on top of that, they discovered oil, or they discovered gas. And hundreds of irrigation wells were put down into this aquifer, and using the gas to power them and start irrigating out there. The irrigation isn't the flood type. They use these rotary things, and the chief crop out there is corn. I mean, they grow yields out there that'll rival what they do in Illinois. Well, not many people live in that area, and so they put they brought the cattle feeding operations and the hog feeding operations out there close to the source of the food for these animals. And you fly over this area now, and you just see these big circles out there, just as far as you can see. Of course, as they pump out this aquifer, they have to keep going deeper and deeper and deeper to get the water. And I've heard that some of that water was laid down the time of Christ, and it is not being replaced. So I'm wondering if eventually that'll be sucked dry, and that country wouldn't grow that type of crops without water. So will it be going put back into grass as it was before the dust storms? Driving around the periphery of this area where the dust storms were really bad, but where wind is a problem. One occasion he sees a cultivated field where the farmer has drilled a row of maize or something similar that grows high ever so often through these fields. He'll drill them east and west, and that is to break the wind, referring to my time in Seattle. I believe that I left, I forgot to say that when I got back from my leave, I was transferred from the APA base on Pier 81 from there I left for Newport, Rhode Island on April 1st. That isn't the way it was. I was transferred from the Pier 81 to the Seattle Naval Hospital about the 1st of November 1944, and I stayed in that in the Naval Hospital until the 1st of April, when I was sent to Newport, Rhode Island. Also, Mary Helen came out to spend about 2 months with me. We lived in Kirkland in some barracks there which Boeing had built for their help, but which they had not needed, and the Navy took them over. They were five units to a barrack, and you could hear any noise made in any one of those barracks, you could hear it all the way through. We burned coal. They'd put coal in a bin out in front, and it would then you'd had a hole in the side of this bin that faces your apartment, and you'd go out and shovel coal out of that. And Joe dearly loved to get up there and go through that hole where the coal came in. Now you can guess how popular that made him with his mother. Well, these barracks were built right against the native forest, right there in the mountains. And Joe and Jade and I would go up there and gather a kindling. We gathered twigs, small branches and stuff like that to bring back to the apartments to help light the coal. The blackberries were wonderful there. When I came into Seattle, they were ripe. And when I left Seattle, they were still ripe. And they were huge. I remember the size of my thumb, but I know that isn't accurate. The bears would fatten up on those things. I was in a donut shop yesterday morning, and I bought a cup of coffee, a couple of donuts, and coffee was a dollar. Well, I'm not complaining about that, but I was thinking back in the Depression years at Enid, there was some individual would go around to all the restaurants and get the coffee grounds. Then he would take it back to some location, and he would rebrew it. And he'd sell the results for a few pennies or maybe a nickel. And from all I ever heard about it, why, he sold all the coffee that he could make that way. Switching to something entirely different. Mary Helen people were all from Kentucky. Well, during the Civil War, Kentucky was a divided state. And Mary Helen had a great-great-great uncle or something who ran a still. The farm on which that still was operating was strictly neutral territory. Both the Union officers and the Confederate officers would come over and buy the whiskey there, and they seemed to get along pretty very well as long as they were in this on this particular farm. Another story that's come down to me after the war, after the Civil War, on the 4th of July, they would be having a big celebration in Fordsville, or one of the towns there, and the Union, ex-Union soldiers and ex-Confederate soldiers were there, and they were getting kind of testy. It looked like there might be a fight brewing, so this uncle, he hitched his horses up to his wagon and went back to his still, loaded on a barrel of whiskey, and brought it over to the where the celebration was going on, and put a dipper there, and by the evening, these boys were all singing together and had their soldiers, their arms around each other's shoulders and telling each other what great guys they were. Now that is diplomacy. Now another story, a local, and I don't know if I can believe this or not, but north of Tonkawa there's a creek called Stink Creek. And the local lore is that in the Wild Wild West days, when there Indians were something to be shot and killed, why, they would kill them and drag their body down and throw in that creek. I find it hard to believe that story. Charlie Beck took care of our place at Billings for many, many years, and Charlie had a terrible, terrible case sinus. Couldn't get any relief. Well, we'd get one of these Oklahoma snowstorms where it'd blow all the snow off the fields into the roads and make huge drifts. And the farmers would come out and with tractors, two different farmers each have a tractor, so that if one got stuck, they could pull the other out, maybe they'd clear the roads. Well, Charlie was out working on this, and he got stuck, and the accompanying tractor put a log chain on it and was pulling him out. The log chain snapped and whipped across Charlie's face and knocked him out. But you know, it completely cured his asthma and any other complications he had. Story of Julia, well, she's learning to talk, and she'd recognize a few words. We were driving down the street one day, and we passed a Conoco station. And she says, "Daddy, what does CO stand for?" And I said, "CO stands for company." She went on a little further. You could feel those cogs of rain turning and turning and turning. And all of a sudden she says, well, company, no company. That's a heck of a name for a filling station. Radically changing the subject here, I believe that every military installation in which I was posted has been closed. The U.S. Little Rock is now berthed in the military park in Buffalo, New York, and it is used as a museum. And radically changing its subject again, when my sister Anna decided to go into nurses training, one of the neighbors there at Garber got in touch with my mother and says, please don't let Anna enter nurses training. Says she'll have to take care of men. What kind of a sexual life did that woman have? Lady in church one day, and she was highly coiffured, well perfumed. A louse crawled down her back. And that's when Bobby penned those immortal couplet, a winsome power gifted ye us to see ourselves as others see us. As I have said before, my parents are both immigrants, and they brought many of their customs to the United States with them. Now, they might sweep the streets clean and their houses would be spotless, but personal cleanliness was not really high on their list. Queen Isabella of Spain bragged that she'd been bathed twice in her life. Once when she was born and once when she was married. Queen Elizabeth, she hired a woman whose sole job was to give her a bath once a month. People, the average person, if they were bathed once a year, they would go to bed a couple of days afterwards because they were sure they would get sick. But what I'm leading up to, I'm sure my parents carried those same standards with them here. If we don't take a shower every day, maybe a couple of showers. Well, we've had it. But there, in the living on the farm there at Garber, six kids, a tub in which to bathe, and there was a 10-gallon hot water reservoir on the side of a wood-burning stove to heat water. I'm sure we weren't given any Saturday night baths. As I remember it, and now understand, I'm thinking about 88 years. As I remember it, I was put into a long-handled underwear in November and taken out in April. And at the bottom of those underwear in April, there was a black band of dirt all the way around. So I'm wondering if maybe this was the same pair of underwear that taken off in April that was put on there in May, or in the previous November. Of course, when summer came, we'd hop into the horse tank. My neighbors had a beautiful pool down there fed with spring water. We'd go down there, and of course we didn't wear any underwear or anything like that. I just wondered if maybe I'd heard us referred to as those dirty immigrants down there, and I just wondered if maybe that might have been a fairly accurate description. No, it makes me wonder, too, in the Bible, it talks so often about frankincense and myrrh, both powerful perfumes, and maybe the people of biblical times, in preference to bathing, they just used perfumes. I wonder if that lack of bathing might not have been the basis of of the entire perfume industry. But back to the main theme here. Mary Helen retired from the library at Enid High School in the 1st of January, 1974. We'd had the flood in the previous October, which was very disheartening, but that probably had little to do with it. She was just, she'd like to have taught for a few more years. She had so much to offer in experience and education and in intelligence, interest in the kids, but trying to get something done there was just like trying to pull an elephant by its nose. She had asked repeatedly for a phone in the library. As it was, a dozen times a day she'd have to interrupt her work, go across the hall, into the office and use their phone. Occasionally it was a personal call, but usually it was something to do with suppliers or questions about what was to be done and all that stuff. And so she, another thing, she came into work 2 weeks early in the fall and got the library shelves all lined up and put in good shape. When the kids enrolled, what did they do? They ran them through the library, and the kids rearranged the books and all that stuff, and the 2 weeks' work that she'd put in was just for naught. She tried to get the authorities to do that enrolling in the auditorium, but they just couldn't see it that way. But these are just discouraging things that all contributed to her retirement. She retired the 1st of January, 1974. I retired the 15th of January, 1977. In between, we took numbers of trips to California to see Julia, and number of trips to New York to see Jane, and Mary Helen got very, very interested in genealogy, and she had a lot of genealogy to be interested in. Now, of course, I can't say a whole lot on my side because my parents, I said, were the first generation. It was I was the first generation, but her people had been here since back in the 1600s. And in our trips to document all these things, we went to New York. We went several times to Kentucky. Of course, were we doing that today, we'd probably get on the internet, and much of that could be gotten by just sitting at the by punching a few buttons. But we lost a lot of interesting trips then. Go back to the old cemeteries there at where her ancestors were buried, and so some of them you could just surmise are here because they're field stones is all they offered. However, one place outside of Fordsville, I don't know whether it was her grandfather there and grandmother or what, but next to them, there was a grave marked Martha, a lady of color, evidently a slave of whom they were very, very, very fond, almost like one of the family. Mary Helen joined the DAR. She joined the ministers of colonial times. She joined the ladies of the colonial times. And she had one minister, great-great-great-grandfather, came to Kentucky in 1800. And he was an itinerant minister. he went around, and of course there weren't any churches or anything of that type, but, and he went around establishing churches, and a number of them still have him as one of the founders. But he walked every place he went. And when he'd have these revivals, they said you didn't need a public address system. He had a voice that would carry for a mile. He must have been some preacher. When I retired in 1977, we determined that we had too much room where we were, and we'd like to move into a smaller town. The market for houses was good. We had paid, in 1973, we had paid $39,000 for the house we were in 1516 South Hayes. We sold it for $75,000 in 1979. And so we looked around at a little small town. We tried Perry. We'd like to have moved there, but we couldn't find anything satisfactory. And in Tonkawa, which is they have a junior college here, just a top-notch junior college. We had a certain amount of knowledge with other towns through having visited friends and Mary Helen having judged contests as such at the college. But we looked around. We couldn't find a house that was suitable. Now, one thing that determined the house we were going to be in was this Steinway grand piano. It took up a lot of room, and most of the houses had small rooms to them. So we bought a lot, and it was a good corner lot. I love it. Johnson glass on it, but that's beside the point. But it was a good corner lot facing the south. But on the east side, there was a cul-de-sac, then the street in the front. On the west side was the alley, and then there was a 10-foot easement across the back. Ideal. And we bought just a set of commercial plans and worked them over to suit our idea of what we wanted, and built a special nick in there for the piano. Reinforced the floor. We didn't have a slab floor. We had a wooden floor. And we moved in there about the 15th of, I guess, February in 1980. And it's been a lovely place, just absolutely a lovely place. In Tonkawa, I joined the Lions Club. We joined the Presbyterian Church. And Mary Helen got into the Garden Club and the different genealogy associations that were here. And we... the neighborhood that we were in, a beautiful neighborhood. Everybody, nobody getting down at somebody else's neck about anything, and they all supportive, and they were here if you needed them, but they weren't nosy about what you were doing. This all came pretty well crashing down at Christmas time in 1998. Mary Helen was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The doctors wanted to put her into an Alzheimer's unit, and I says, no way, says, I'll take care of her. Now, what did I know about taking care of someone with Alzheimer's, or for any other disease for that matter? Of course, for a while, she could help herself some, eat, with help walk, and that type of stuff, and care for herself. But she was gradually getting deteriorating. And one day there was a knock on the door, and there was a lady. I didn't know her from a bale of hay. And she said, "I've come to take care of you." Well, Julia had gotten in touch with the hospital here and told what they needed. And there was this lady who was free at the moment. She'd had 15 years experience in this type of thing. And she came in, and Opal Page, her name, she came in and helped me get things lined out with Mary Helen. Mary Helen needed care 24 hours a day, and we tried hiring a third person, and all we could get is people come in here, draw a paycheck or two, and quit. Well, that was not only hard on us, but it was especially hard on Mary Helen. So one day Opal said, "Let's see if you and I can't handle this ourselves." She agreed to come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, stay till 5, 7 days a week. Try to find that help today. And then I took over at night. And I don't know, she must have kept up that for year and a half. Mary Helen was sick for 2.5 years. But when Mary Helen finally died, I told Opal, "Well, I guess I'll do it alone from now." I said, "I'll pay you a month's service pay." Well, Opal hit me at both feet about the very idea of trying to do this alone. Well, Julia was here for Mary Helen's funeral, and when Opal quit, Julia took up. So I got the idea, and Opal stayed on, and she's still with me. Now that's, she came in 1998, and she's here...
Six.
And she comes in every morning, does a little lighthouse work, gets my noon meal, and does the laundry and all those sorts of things. Things which I could do by myself, but it's so much nicer when there's somebody else to do them. As for my health, my hearing is very, very poor, and eyesight's very good. I have a tendency to... my immune system's very low, and so I have a tendency to get pneumonia. I got out of the hospital last week after 2 weeks in there with pneumonia. I believe that's the fifth time I've had it since
2000.
I walk with a cane. I have to have that. I mean, I'm pretty wobbly if I don't have the cane, but I feel good, and I don't watch TV. Mary Helen and I used to watch it together, but watching it by myself is just like eating potatoes without a salt on it. So I haven't turned that thing on in 5 years. I do lots and lots of reading, which is a good solitary occupation and a very enjoyable one. I go to Lyons on Thursday at noon, and Presbyterian Church, Sunday School and Church on Sunday morning. It's a small congregation. My goodness, if we have 25 people in there, we've got a pretty good congregation. But we got some of the most beautiful windows in there, antique windows. I don't know, the church was dedicated in 1906, I believe it was, or four. And the windows had come to it from some church that had been wrecked in the east. I put the church, I worked on the church with a girl from the art department in Oklahoma State, and got it on the National Historical Register. But these windows I've tried to trace, and I couldn't get anywhere. I heard that they came from an Episcopal church in the East, and so I got close to the head quack of the Episcopal church in Philadelphia and told them what I needed. Wanted to know if they had a record of any churches being wrecked in that area, and about that time they said, well, we've got a room in the basement full of all sorts of that type of records. And if you, it's never been organized. Said, if you want to come up here and go down there, well, I said, you're welcome to do so. Well, that sounded like a lifetime work, and I'm not that much interested in Philadelphia. Jane phones me nearly every day, and I see her once or twice a year, which is fine. She has her life to live, and Glennis and Anna, the grandchildren, they phone me occasionally, and as I say, that's great. We keep in touch, and they have their very definite life to live, and I can't really see there's anything here for any of them, and they have interesting places where they are. I go out to the farm as often as I can, and nothing much out there, but I get little projects going out there, and it's farm probably just well off if I didn't go out there, but at the same time I enjoy it there. It's get out where there's no phones, no nothing, and I have a cell phone in case I get in trouble, and that's about all that I need there. Considering everything, I don't believe that I could live in a better place than Tonka, Oklahoma. I've got to go out for my walks. Everything is paved, and everybody looks out for me. I go in, I try to do 3 miles a day, 2 miles in the morning and 1 mile at night, and do about an hour in a wellness center up there. Nothing radical, but just keeping reasonably fit. I own my own home. I have a car, which I don't drive very much, but I drive as much as I need to. I go to the grocery store, go to the church, go over to Ponca City maybe once a week, and Enid maybe once a month. And I probably don't put over 300 or 400 miles a month on the car if I put that many. I feel that I've had a good life. No. I want to amend it. I feel that I've got a good life. I don't know just how it could be improved upon, so long as my health stays reasonably good, my mind stays reasonably clear, and I enjoy what I'm doing. What more can a person ask out of life?